Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our daily Dhamma session. It might be interesting for you all to know that the whole idea of doing a daily Dhamma talk, it's something I've just started, but I've done it before, and it comes out of the setup at my teacher's monastery. Back when I was a young monk, every day, actually morning and evening, Jantong would, as long as he didn't have something else to do or somewhere else to be, he would come for morning chanting, evening chanting, and every day would give a talk in the morning and in the evening, sometimes 5 minutes, sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes longer. But every day he would give a little bit of Dhamma. It really created a sense of community and sense of the being together in a monastery. So it made me think, because that's just sort of what we're creating here, right? That we're all around the world, and we have meditators here at the monastery. It's our one chance to come together. The meditators are off in their rooms meditating, and everyone here is off living your lives. But it's a lot like being together in the monastery, right? Every day we can do a meditation session together around 7 p.m., 8 p.m. And then at 9 p.m. we come together, and just as though we were living together in a monastery, come together and listen to the Dhamma. Carrying on this tradition, carrying on Buddhist tradition. The Buddhist tradition that I follow is, it's fairly specific. We have what we call the Theravada, which means, Thera means elder, Ovada or Vada means the teaching or the point of view or the doctrine. And by elders we mean this specific set of texts that have been handed down by specific set of monks. Not all monks. Some monks don't follow these texts. We have texts that claim to be written by the came to be copies of what the Buddha actually said. We have texts that are explanations and extrapolations on those texts. And then we have texts that are again extrapolations and explanations of those texts. We have stories that are supposed to be stories the Buddha told, or stories that recount events in the Buddha's life. We've got the rules for monks. We've got the talks that the Buddha gave. We've got the Abhidhamma, which is lists and lists and classifications of Dhammas, of reality, really, of experience. We have a cohesive tradition. This is Buddhist, Theravada Buddhist tradition. And also we have a meditation tradition. So the meditation, that tradition that I teach, goes the way of the Mahasi Sayadaw and his teacher, the Mingun Sayadaw, Mingun Jetwan Sayadaw. It goes the way of Ajahn Tong, who I think personalize the teaching of it on his own. It's a specific tradition. We have, again, this idea of tradition. But these two together, I think, make up the essence of of what the tradition would call Buddhism. We have in one of these ancient texts this quote. Apparently the Buddha said, he was asked by an old monk. There was an old monk who was concerned about being able to fulfill all of the duties because he had become a monk in his old age, and so he asked the Buddha, "Kati bante durani? How many duties are there in this sasana?" And the Buddha said, "Dve me bhikkhu durani." Oh, monk, there are these two. There are only two. These two duties in this sasana, in this religion, in this teaching. Ganta turancha vipassana turang. Or actually a little bit, it goes in a little more detail, I can't remember the quote. So this comes in one of the commentaries, and some people might say, well, how do we know this is actually something the Buddha said? Doesn't really matter. The point is, here we have a concise enumeration of the things we have to do. Only two things. It's often a question, maybe not a conscious question, but one in our minds. What does it mean to be Buddhist? Especially when we come to practice intensively. What are two things that we should do? Maybe we get the idea that there are many things we should be doing. We think of all the many teachings of the Buddha. What does it all boil down to? What do we have to do? So ganta dhura. Ganta means sort of gathering or something, or threads or something. What it means is study. We have to spend some time in scholastic endeavor, studying the Buddha's teaching. And of course, vipassana dura, we know this is the duty or the task of trying to come to see clearly. So on the one hand, we have all this text, and we have the textual tradition that we have to follow. We have to carry on, in fact. And we have meditation tradition, where it's our duty and our task to practice to see clearly. And in our story with this old monk, he says to the Buddha, "Oh, I don't think I'll be able to practice ganta dura. I won't be able to study to completion. There's just so much, and here my memory is not good. I'm old. But vipassana dura, that's something I can do. Is it okay if I just stick to vipassana dura?" And the Buddha was okay with that. It seems these two are not something that everyone has to do, but they are that which we as Buddhists have to carry on. So if no one were to carry on the texts and to study the texts, well, we would lose the path, we would lose the way to become enlightened. And on the other hand, if we were to just focus on the texts and no one were to practice insight meditation, of course the texts would become useless and incomprehensible. If we don't actually take the time to practice to gain insight, and we're not likely to, the texts become meaningless. We're not likely to understand them in the future. Without people to verify and explain them from a practical perspective. So let's talk about these two, because this, the textual tradition and the meditative tradition, these are the two Buddhist traditions that we follow. So the textual tradition, we've got lots of teachings. We have 84,000 teachings by one estimation This is what the texts themselves say that they contain. 84,000 teachings. Now, that may just be a euphemism or a simplification for a lot, because it seems 84,000 was a common number. But at any rate, we do have a lot. We've got the Vinaya Pitika, which is full of all the different rules and norms of behavior. Mostly things we shouldn't do, but a lot of prescriptive things as well that we should do. A way to act and speak and deport oneself properly as sort of a basis for the practice of meditation. Then we have the Sutta Pitika, which is full of a lot of meditative teachings, but describes all of the many talks that the Buddha gave. The Buddha was here and said this to this person. Ways and means by which the Buddha passed on his message and evoked proper inclination. So it wasn't just about passing on information, but the Sutta Pitaka is full of inspiration and adaptation of the teachings to suit particular audiences. What you get out of it is not just information, but you get a sense of the real feeling of being a meditator. And you get this encouragement from the Buddha and this shaping and molding of our minds by the ways the Buddha taught and adapted the teachings. So the great thing about studying all of these is that you get a broad idea of the different ways that the teaching can be presented, and you're able to pick that which resonates with you and approach the teaching from different ways. And then we have the Abhidhamma Pitika, which really lays out the foundation for insight practice by not containing talks that the Buddha gave, but actually containing pure information. So giving a pure classification of the Dhammas that really provides an actual precise roadmap. You know, the connections between good states and happiness and bad states and suffering. And the different connections of cause and effect and supportive causes and hindering causes and so on, and really the way things work together. Really gives a detailed analysis of reality, and on the whole allows us or gives us a glimpse at the way we should understand reality, or sort of the paradigm we should undertake. Even if you don't understand the whole of the Abhidhamma, it's easy to see through the Buddha's description of the various mind states and the qualities of mind and so on, that when we speak of reality in Buddhism, what we mean is experience. What we mean is not time and space and the universe and the cosmos and the planets and the stars, not even particles or subatomic particles, atoms, molecules. But what we mean is the physical and mental aspects of experience. So it gives us, again, this, not just information, but it helps us understand, provides a framework or a foundation for reality. But again, like this old monk, we can plead off, oh, studying all of this seems daunting. Now, for many of us, we do have the time. Many of us don't have the time. It's important to understand that this is not the end of the Buddha's teaching. It's not enough to spend all of your time studying, and so if that's all that you have time for, you've really missed the point of the teachings. So we have to adapt the teachings, and we can expand and contract the teachings, and it's like a hologram in some ways, I think. You can pick one part and you find the hole in that part. For example, the three Pitikas, you know, these in summary, these deal with sila, samadhi, and panya, morality, concentration, and wisdom. Right. So morality is the things that keep us, keep our actions and our speech in check. It's those acts and words that we should avoid, or ways of avoiding gross defilement, you know, actions that we're going to regret and that are going to cause us stress and suffering. Same with speech. That's basically what the Vinaya Pitaka does and what it's for, why it was organized into that group. The Sutta Pitaka mainly deals, when it's boiled down, it mainly deals with meditation or concentration or focus. It's about actual practice. It's practical. It has many methods and means by which the Buddha would help us to cultivate, or help his audience to cultivate wholesome states and progress on the path. Samadhi. And the Abhidhamma Pitaka, of course, deals with pure wisdom. It mimics the understanding that a meditator gets through practice. It describes it. Describes what wisdom is. You can't gain wisdom by reading the Abhidhamma, but you can get a map, sort of an outline, a framework for what wisdom would look like, which can be quite useful. Of course, all of this can get in the way if you study too much. Then when you meditate, you're just thinking, because thinking is a habit. Studying itself is a practice, and it has consequences. But if you study just enough and in proportion with your practice, it gives you this map, this framework to allow you to understand reality. And so the Dipitaka really boils down to morality, concentration, and wisdom, which can then be expanded if you want to go to understand. It's expanded into the Eightfold Noble Path. The Eightfold Noble Path, we have right view and right thought. This is wisdom. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. This is morality. And right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the concentration or the samadhi aspect. And each of those can then be expanded as well, and sometimes you just pick one and you can cultivate. Each one of them can become the essence of your practice. For example, right view is again the Four Noble Truths, which also contain the Eightfold Noble Path. Right mindfulness, of course, is the most common one, because right mindfulness is the four foundations of mindfulness, and the four foundations of mindfulness again contain all the other elements of the path. They contain the Four Noble Truths, for example. Ultimately, if you're really lazy or in a hurry to become enlightened, you don't have to worry too much about study at all. In the commentary, the tradition, the texts themselves, the commentarial texts, talk about the canonical texts, and they say, Sakalampihite Pitakang, the entirety of the three Pitakas can be summarized under one word, and that's appamadapada. The path of appamada, which is vigilance or religence, heedfulness, sometimes translated, which again just means to be mindful. And so our study, whether it be much or whether it be little, it comes down to this. It comes down to understanding and getting a sense of the right direction for our practice. As to Vipassana Dura, Well, vipassana is a word that probably doesn't need much introduction. Most of us are familiar with it, but our understanding may be partial or skewed or so on. It's important that we understand this. Vipassana is, I remember many, many years ago, a monk, I think in a Pali lesson, we were talking about Pali words, and someone mentioned the word vipassana and where it comes from, and he said, this word isn't found in the Tipitaka. This was a scholarly, well-versed monk, and I was quite surprised to hear this. The word vipassana does appear in the Tipitaka, but I think what he meant is that it's not, the vipassana meditation isn't described in the Tipitaka. And nonetheless, there's some very good quotes that help us understand vipassana. What is it that we're doing here when we come to practice meditation? What are we practicing? Very much in the Tipitaka means, which means in the closest thing we have to the actual teachings of the Buddha, what we are told and what we tend to believe are actual direct teachings handed down that were given by the Buddha. So the most important one, there's several, but the most important one is, it doesn't actually mention the word vipassana, but it uses the words, sees with wisdom. So vipassana, passana means seeing, vi, the prefix vi, this is the question, what does it mean? But we have a very good example of what it means when the Buddha says panyaya passati, sees with wisdom. When one sees with wisdom, the vi, it just means wisdom. The Buddha says we see three things with wisdom. When we practice vipassana meditation, what are we trying to see? And the Buddha said, sabbe sankhara anicca. All formations are impermanent. That looks like the sound is cutting out in Second Life, which is probably just a problem with that. Anyway, sorry for the interruption. Impermanence, right? Everything is impermanent. Sabbe sankhara anicca, all formations are impermanent. So we come to see through our practice that reality is not made up of things, people, places, things. These are all concepts. And they arise and cease in the mind, but they arise and cease momentarily. And reality is just made up of moments. Sabbe sankhara dukkha. All formations are dukkha. Which it's something we have to hedge and sort of explain grudgingly, because it's too harsh if you just say, oh, all formations are suffering. People think, well, that's kind of a dreary outlook, and it's not really what is meant. Again, these are qualities of things. Dukkha means, it really means in relation to us, they can't make us happy and they cause us suffering. They're not suffering in themselves, but they cause us suffering. Or they are capable of only providing suffering. Just like if you have a drink and you say it's poisonous. Well, the drink sitting there is not poison. It's not going to kill you. But it's poisonous in relation to us if we drink it. So all formations are dukkha. Means when you cling to them, when you take them on, this is me, this is mine, and so on, when you seek them out, you suffer. They are unsatisfying, they are not happiness, they themselves cannot be a source of your happiness. And finally, sabbe dhamma anatta, all dhammas, formations, and all realities really are non-self. Means they have no lasting self. They arise and they cease momentarily. Oh, well, that's not even true of all dhammas. But the point is, there is no self. There is nothing in them that arises, or nothing arisen. That they are not the self. They are not ours. They are not under our control. They don't belong to us. They are not me. They are not mine. But again, this is not theory, but this is how a meditator experiences reality. So, impermanence. Everything will be chaotic when you start to practice. It will shake you up. Because meditation will not be a comfortable thing, at least not in the beginning, as it forces you to experience this reality, to not have anything to cling to. How can you survive if you have nothing to hold on to? This is the challenge. We're so accustomed to holding on to, fixing in our mind, this is what I'm aiming for, this is my goal, this is what I want. And that keeps us stable. Suffering, but stable. When you let go of it, how do you live? How do you find peace? How do you be at peace? It's not easy. So you see the suffering, impermanence, you see suffering, the stress of things, and you see how when you do hold on to anything, this is stressful, watching as things arise and cease, things that you hold on to, may it stay, they disappear. Things you worry about, may they not come, and then they come. And as you can't control, you're not in charge. Another important aspect of vipassana is the present moment. So another important quote that we have of the Buddha where he says, Pachupanancha yo dhammang tatha tatha vipassati. Vipassati is just another form of the word vipassana. It's the same exact word. Vipassati is the verb, vipassana is the noun. So one sees clearly everything that arises in the present moment. Whatever dhammas arise in the present moment, one sees them clearly. And the point here being, sees clearly impermanent, suffering, non-self, and sees the three characteristics. But the important thing is here and now. Meditation isn't about the future. It's not about a goal that you're striving for. It's not about the past, who you've become and who you are. It's about seeing reality, which is only in the present moment, and it's only in our experience. It's not in the world out there or in who we are as our being. It's not in our relationships with other people. Reality is in the experience, moment to moment. So we come to see impermanent, suffering, non-self in our experiences. Seeing that anytime we cling to anything, we suffer. That reality is not meant to be clung to. There's no benefit from clinging or identifying with things. We see all this for ourselves. This is what it means, vipassana dura. This is the great duty that we're, the great task that we're undertaking. And this is how we carry on the Buddhist tradition. This is how we carry on his traditions that have been handed down century after century. We continue through our patience, through our care. We continue to care for the Buddhist teaching and pass it on and keep it pure and keep it alive. And so I'd like to express my appreciation for everyone for doing this, for taking up the study of the Buddhist teaching, even if it just means listening to talks, and most especially for taking up, like this old monk, well, at the very least we take up meditation, which is still a perfectly valid way of carrying on the Buddhist tradition. Because it's only when we understand the teachings that we can really and truly pass them on. So there you go. There's the Dhamma for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. I wish you all good practice. So it appears that this is a trend that we're going to have to look forward to in Second Life. Maybe it's a reason to give up Second Life entirely, I don't know. Is the audio back? It looks like the audio's back now in Second Life. It seems like around 9:20, probably everyone in Second Life logs on at once. Unfortunately. That's all. You can all go back and continue your practice. Don't stay. Please go back and continue. I stay here. I answer some questions sometimes. So. How can one know what stage of samsara they are in? Well, those aren't stages of samsara per se, but I get what you're saying. Well, it's I think it's increasingly easy. As an arahant, it's pretty hard to miss that. But for a sotapanna, one knows. One knows through, generally through the adherence to the precepts, through a lack of doubt about the Buddha's teaching, and through having, yeah, those two really, having perfect faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and keeping the precepts, having a innate sense of keeping basically the five precepts. I mean, there's no sign. It's not like you can examine yourself and say, oh, that means I'm a sotapanna. But a sotapanna has seen nibbana and often can attain this a cessation of suffering through the practice, so through repeated experience of nibbana, and then they can be clear that this is, you know, that they're seeing nibbana, and as a result, of course, they are sotapanna, at least sotapanna. Do you recommend that meditators do chanting? What are the benefits? I answer this, you know, from time to time. I answer this. This is a reoccurring question. I mean, yes, it's useful. One of the benefits, of course, is remembering the Buddha's teaching, if you chant the Buddha's teaching. So it's a great way to practice gantatura. Of course, it's a sort of a meditative state. It's a good way to calm the mind, basically. It's a good way to cultivate wholesome qualities by recollecting the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. There's lots of benefits to chanting. I mean, it's not, Ajahn Tong said this is like there's two kinds of medicine. There's medicine that you eat, and there's medicine that you apply topically as a salve. So the medicine that goes on your skin, it doesn't usually heal. It just mitigates the symptoms. So mostly that medicine is not considered a cure, but it makes you feel good. Whereas medicine that you eat tends to provide a cure. I mean, it's just an analogy, but that's the idea. Okay, so we had this question basically asking, do you need to get rid of the five hindrances, or can you engage in activities Should you continue to engage in activities that promote the five hindrances? Or will they get in the way? Or by practicing them, will you eventually come to realize that they're problematic? So let's sort of lay this out clearly. There are two types of ethical precepts, I would say. I mean, this is actually, I think, my own understanding. It's not particularly spelled out clearly in anything I've read, but so there are precepts that are ethically, practically dangerous and detrimental, directly detrimental to your practice. In other words, by engaging in these acts, you're getting further away from Nibbana. I mean, I don't think this is a cut and dried categorization, but it's important to understand the distinction. Because clearly some acts that we do are making it harder and harder for us to become enlightened. So actually detracting from our practice. The other type of act is not necessarily detrimental, but is hindering in the sense it slows us down. It means our practice is going to progress more slowly. I think it's important to see that distinction, because a lot of what we do is for entertainment and so on, I would say it's not, I mean, it depends how you look at it, but I don't think it'd be really fair to say that this is making you, bringing you away from the Buddhist teaching. It's just making it harder for you to see, making it, you know, it's dragging you, dragging behind you. So this example of playing computer games, well, yes, that's definitely going to make it harder for you to become enlightened. I mean, 9 times out of 10, it's possible, as I was saying, it's possible to become enlightened doing anything if you start to use it as an object of meditation and start to realize that what you're doing is useless and so on. But at the same time, you're cultivating bad habits. You know, you're cultivating habits of attachment, and these are going to prevent you from seeing clearly. So I wouldn't, in general, say that they're going to take you away from the Buddhist teaching. They're just going to make it a lot slower, because you're dealing with these habits and you have to clear them out every time you meditate, as opposed to someone staying in a meditation center who doesn't have to, who can progress quite rapidly. You could argue maybe that if a person were to denounce video games, say, and say, no, I'm never going to play video games, and just stay at home and try to meditate, they might build up resentment and you know, the repression, I guess we would, in the West we would call it repression, where you build up this aversion to the desire to play video games or to do whatever. And that can be problematic. So there is an argument there that if you're not actually dealing with these, like monks who are try to be celibate but aren't actually practicing meditation, well, then they end up engaging in sexual acts anyway, sometimes molesting young boys and that kind of thing. It's really awful what happens. Because rather than meditating, they're just trying, or maybe not even trying. But so someone would thereby make an argument, well, they'd be better off being a layperson, just having a wife or a husband or whatever. And you know, that's a fair argument. But it doesn't mean that, you know, having sex at all is useful, and it's going to help you understand that sex is problematic. You don't need that. It's actually going to make it more difficult because of the habits. The point being that the only thing that's going to lead to enlightenment is an understanding of reality. So repressing your desires and your aversions, oh, that's not going to help. And indulging in them, well, that's not going to help. Those are two really pretty bad habits. But at some point, no matter what you're doing, whether you're engaging in unwholesome activities or whether you're not engaging in unwholesome activities, I mean, there's no such thing as wholesome or unwholesome activities. The point is, where is your mind? So it's about getting to the point, however you get there, where you can see reality as it is. These habits, bad habits that are cultivated through, for example, playing video games or whatever it might be, they're not doing that. Those habits are are different and are problematic, are unwholesome, because they're going to lead to suffering, and they encourage delusion, they make it harder for you to see clearly. But when you're playing video games, if you start to be mindful, you can start to say, well, this is useless, this is pointless, this is stressful and not actually making me a better person, a more happy person, a more peaceful person, so I'll give it up. Is it possible to experience Magapala without a blinking of the sense gates? Well, since Magga and Pala both take Nibbana as an object, I'm not sure what you're trying to determine here. I mean, Nibbana is, it's without any of the senses, so. Can we put suttas like Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, Anattalakkhana Sutta, Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta to the Samadhi section? They seem to be leaning more towards Panya. Yeah, well, I mean, the point being that these are the teachings that the Buddha gave to help people practice meditation. They aren't descriptions of reality per se. I mean, they're talks is what I think what is being referred to. The Buddha, these are practical. So yes, they contain, of course, the Abhidhamma, because you need to teach the Abhidhamma, but they're actual teachings. They're actual meditation instruction. What the Buddha was trying to do with the Sutta Pitaka, with all the teachings in the Sutta Pitaka, for the most part, and pretty much, is teach people meditation. Now, part of that is teaching the Abhidhamma, but he was actually teaching it. I guess the different point being, hey, through this they will come to see these truths. Abhidhamma is different because it's a bare description of the truth. But of course, I mean, these are all interrelated. I mean, the Vinaya Pitaka also has wisdom in it, I would say. Maybe not so much, but they certainly blend together. But there's a difference in that the Sutta Pitaka is appealing to people. It's teaching them. The Nibbana of an arahant is a different usage of the word Nibbana. So when we talk about Nibbana as an experience, it's the experience of cessation, Nirodha. But an arahant has a different kind of cessation in the sense that no more defilements can ever arise. There has been a cessation. A cutting off in that sense. But it doesn't mean that at every moment they experience Nibbana. It depends how you're using the word. The way we use it technically is an actual experience where one enters into a Nirodha, Pala Samapati or Nirodha Samapati or that kind of thing. So it's an Abhidhamma sort of Nibbana. But the Sutta Nibbana is what you're talking about, the Arahant. The life of an arahant is a life of Nibbana, but it's a Sutta Nibbana, it's not an Abhidhamma Nibbana. It's just a usage of the word. It's not an actual experience. It's a description, but it's not real. Reality isn't that. Reality is moments of experience or experience of Nibbana, for example. You're all welcome. So I think I've talked enough. If there are no immediate questions, I'm going to say goodnight. Oh, one more, okay. One more, last one. For those who aren't advanced enough to achieve Nibbana in this life, does study of the teaching lead to a better chance to advance in the next life? I mean, you can't make such a sweeping statement. Someone could study the teachings and go to hell, for example. I mean, maybe generally, maybe broadly speaking, it's hard to imagine someone actively studying the Buddha's teaching unless they were to I mean, it's hard to imagine that some wholesomeness wouldn't arise, but the point is that wholesomeness has to arise. The only thing that makes it easier to practice or leads you closer to the Buddha's teaching is wholesomeness, goodness. So this is the question, is what is coming out of your study? It's quite possible that someone could study the Buddha's teaching without gaining any benefit. It's just not very likely. It's most likely that anyone who's studying the Buddha's teaching would gain some appreciation. Of course, there are people who study the Buddha's teachings just so they can find fault with it. People of other religions would learn it, and it would be hard-pressed to say that they gained much benefit out of it. So study alone won't give you that, but most people who study are also gaining wholesomeness. They're also, to some extent, putting the teachings into practice, at least as far as appreciating them, internalizing them and saying this is good. I mean, that sort of thing is wholesome and is going to support your practice. All right, so that's all for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in, for coming out. Have a good night.